A, and he stopped. Stays E, doesn't it? I said. Sorry. The first three lines were all in E, but when I switched to A again, where most basic rock goes, it was still wrong. Where? I asked Norman. He just looked at me, hands in his back pockets. I listened in my head, then began again. When I got to the fourth line, I went to C, and that was right. I had to start over once more, but after that it was a cinch. All we needed was drums, a bass, and some lead guitar, of course. John Fogerty of Creedence hammered that lead in a way I never could in my wildest dreams. Give me the axe, Norman said. I handed it over, disappointed to let it go. Thanks for letting me play it, I said, and headed for the door. Wait a minute, Morton. It wasn't much of a change, but at least I had been promoted from freshie. Audition's not over. Audition? From the storage cabinet, he took a smaller case, opened it, and produced a scratched-up K semi-hollow body, a 900G if you keep a score. Plug it into the amp, but turn it down to 4. That K feeds back like a motherfucker. I did as instructed. The K fit my body better than the Yammy. I wouldn't have to hunch over to play it. There was a pick threaded into the strings, and I took it out. Ready? I nodded. 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, and... I was nervous while I was working out the simple rhythm progression of Green River, but if I'd known how well Norman could play, I don't think I could have played at all. I would simply have fled the room. He hit the Fogerty lead just right, playing the same licks as on that old fantasy single. As it was, I was swept along. Louder, he shouted at me. Jack it, and fuck the feedback. I turned the big amp up to 8 and kicked it back in. With both guitars playing and the amp feeding back like a police whistle, Norm's voice was lost in the sound. It didn't matter. I stuck the groove and let his lead carry me. It was like surfing a glassy wave that rolled on without breaking for 2.5 minutes. It ended, and silence crashed back in. My ears were ringing. Norm stared up at the ceiling, considering, then nodded. Not great, but not terrible. With a little practice, you might be better than Snuffy. Who's Snuffy? I asked, my ears ringing. A guy who's moving to Massachusetts, he said. Let's try Needles and Pins. You know the Searchers?
E?
No, this one's D, but not straight D. You gotta diddle it. He demonstrated how I was supposed to hammer high E with my pinky, and I picked it up right away. It didn't sound exactly like the record, but it was in the ballpark. When we finished, I was dripping with sweat. Okay, he said, unslinging the guitar. Let's go out to the SA. I need a butt. The smoking area was behind the vocational tech building. It was where the Burns and hippies hung out, along with girls who wore tight skirts, dangly earrings, and too much makeup. Two guys were squatting at the far end of the metal shop. I'd seen them around, as I had Norman, but didn't know them. One had sandy blonde hair and a lot of acne. The other had a kinky pad of red hair that stuck out in 9 different directions. They looked like losers, but I didn't care. Norman Irving also looked like a loser, but he was the best guitar player I'd ever heard who wasn't on a record. How is he? The sandy blonde asked. This turned out to be Kenny Laughlin. Better than Snuffy, Norman said. The one with the crazy red hair grinned. Aw, that ain't saying shit. Yeah, but we need someone or we can't play the Grange on Saturday night. He produced a pack of Cools and tipped it my way. Smoke? I don't, I said, and then feeling absurd, but not able to help myself. Sorry. Norman ignored that and lit up with a Zippo that had a snake and Don't Tread on Me engraved on the side. This is Kenny Laughlin. Plays bass. The redhead is Paul Bouchard. Drums. The shrimp is Connie Morton's brother. Jamie, I said. I desperately wanted these guys to like me, to let me in. But I didn't want to start whatever relationship we might have as nothing more than Mr. Football's kid brother. I'm Jamie, I held out my hand. Their shakes were as limp as Norman's had been. I've gigged with hundreds of players since the day Norman Irving auditioned me in the GFHS band room, and almost every guy I ever worked with had the same dead fish shake. It's as if rockers feel they have to save all their strength for work. So, what do you say? Norman asked. Want to be in a band? Did I? If he told me I had to eat my own shoelaces as an initiation rite, I would have pulled them from the eyelets immediately and started chewing. Sure, but I can't play in any places where they serve booze. I'm only 14. They looked at each other, surprised, then laughed. We'll worry about playing the Hawley and the Deuce Four once we get a rep, Norm said, jetting smoke from his nostrils. For now, we're just playing teen dances, like the one at the Eureka Grange. That's where you're from, right, Harlow? How low, Kenny Laughlin said, snickering. That's what we call it, as in how low can you shit-kickers go? Listen, you want to play, right? Norm said. He lifted his legs so he could bogart his cigarette on one of his battered old Beetle boots. Your brother says you're playing his Gibson, which doesn't have a pickup, but you can use a K. The music department won't care? The music department won't know. Come to the Grange on Thursday afternoon. I'll bring the K. Just don't break the stupid feedbacky fucker. We'll set up and rehearse. Bring a notebook so you can write down the chords. The bell rang. Kids butted their smokes and started drifting back toward the school. As one of the girls passed, she kissed Norman on the cheek and patted him on the butt of his sagging jeans. He seemed not to notice her, which struck me as incredibly sophisticated. My respect for him went up another notch. None of my fellow bandmates showed any signs of heeding the bell, so I started off on my own. Then another thought crossed my mind, and I turned back. What's the name of the band? Norm said, we used to call ourselves the Gunslingers, but people thought that was a little too, you know, militaristic, so now we're Chrome Roses. Kenny thought it up while we were stoned and watching a gardening show at my dad's place. Cool, huh? In the quarter century that followed, I played with the J-Tones, Robin and the Jays, and the Hey Jays, all led by a snazzy guitarist named Jay Pedersen. I played with the Heaters, the Stiffs, the Undertakers, Last Call, and the Andersonville Rockers. During the flowering of punk, I played with Patsy Cline's Lipstick, the Test Tube Babies, Afterbirth, and the World is Full of Bricks. I even played with a rockabilly group called Does Does Call the Fuzz. But there was never a better name for a band, in my opinion, than Chrome Roses. I don't know, Mom said. She didn't look mad. She looked like she was coming down with a headache. You're only 14, Jamie. Conrad says those boys are much older. We were at the dinner table, which looked a lot bigger with Claire and Andy gone. Do they smoke? No, I said. My mother turned to Con. Do they? Con, who was passing the creamed corn to Terry, didn't miss a beat. Nope. I could have hugged him. We had our differences over the years, as all brothers do, but brothers also have a way of sticking together when the chips are down. It's not bars or anything, Mom, I said, knowing in some intuitive way that it would be bars, and probably long before the most junior member of Chrome Roses turned 21. Just the Grange. We have rehearsal this Thursday. You'll need plenty, Terry said snidely. Give me another pork chop. Say please, Terrence, my mother said distractedly. Please give me another pork chop. Dad passed the platter. He hadn't said anything. That could be good or bad. How will you get to rehearsal? For that matter, how will you get to these gigs? Norm's got a VW microbus. Well, it's his dad's, but he let Norm paint the band's name on the side. This Norm can't be more than 18, Mom said. She had stopped eating her food. How do I know he's a safe driver? Mom, they need me. The rhythm guy moved to Massachusetts. With no rhythm guy, they'll lose the gig Saturday night. A thought blazed across my mind like a meteor. Astrid Soderbergh might be at that dance. It's important. It's a big deal. I don't like it. Now she was rubbing her temples. My father spoke up at last. Let him do it, Laura. I know you're worried, but it's what he's good at. She sighed. All right, I guess. Thanks, Mom. Thanks, Dad. My mother picked up her fork, then put it down. Promise me that you won't smoke cigarettes or marijuana and that you won't drink. I promise, I said. And that was a promise I kept for 2 years, or thereabouts. What I remember best about that first gig at Eureka Grange No. 7 was the stench of my own sweat as the four of us trooped onto the bandstand. When it comes to sweat, nobody can beat an adolescent of 14. I had showered for 20 minutes before my maiden show until the hot water ran out. But when I bent to pick up my borrowed guitar, I reeked of fear. The K seemed to weigh at least 200 pounds when I slung it over my shoulder. I had good reason to be scared. Even taking the inherent simplicity of rock and roll into account, a task Norm Irving set me, learning 30 songs between Thursday afternoon and Saturday night, was impossible, and I told him so. He shrugged and offered me the most useful advice I ever got as a musician. When in doubt, lay out. Besides, he said, baring his decaying teeth in a fiendish grin, I'm going to be turned up so loud they won't hear what you're doing anyway. Paul rolled a short riff on his drums to get the crowd's attention, finishing with a cymbal clang. There was a brief spatter of anticipatory applause. There were all those eyes, millions, it seemed to me, looking up at the little stage where we were crowded together under the lights. I remember feeling incredibly stupid in my rhinestone-studded vest. The vests were holdovers from the brief period when Chrome Roses had been the gunslingers, and wondering if I was going to vomit. It hardly seemed possible, since I'd only picked at lunch and hadn't been able to eat any supper at all, but it sure felt that way. And then I thought, not vomit, faint. That's what I'm going to do, faint. I really might have, but Norm didn't give me time. We're Chrome Roses, okay? You guys get up and dance. Then to us, 1, 2, you know what to do. Paul Bouchard laid down the tom-tom drum beat that opens Hang On Sloopy, and we were off. Norm sang lead, except for a couple of songs when Kenny took over, he always did. Paul and I did backing vocals. I was terribly shy about that at first, but the feeling passed when I heard how different my amplified voice sounded. How adult. Later on, I realized that no one pays much attention to the backup singers anyway, although they'd miss those voices if they were gone. I watched the couples move under the floor and start to dance. It was what they'd come for, but in my deepest heart, I hadn't believed they would. Not the music I was a part of. When it became clear to me that we weren't going to be booed off the stage, I felt a rising euphoria that was close to ecstasy. I've taken enough drugs to sink a battleship since then, but not even the best of them could equal that first rush. We were playing. They were dancing. We played from 7 until 10:30, with a 20-minute break around 9, when Norm and Kenny dropped their instruments, turned off their amps, and dashed outside to smoke. For me, those hours passed in a dream, so I wasn't surprised when during one of the slower numbers, I think it was Who'll Stop the Rain, my mother and father waltzed by. Mom's head was on Dad's shoulder. Her eyes were closed, and there was a dreamy little smile on her face. My dad's eyes were open, and he gave me a wink as they passed the bandstand. There was no need to be embarrassed by their presence. Although the high school dances and the pal hops at the Lewiston roller rink were strictly for kids, there were always a lot of adults when we played at the Eureka Grange, or the Elks, and Amvets and Gates. The only thing wrong with that first gig was that, although some of Astrid's friends were there, she wasn't. My folks left early, and Norm drove me home in the old microbus. We were all high on our success, laughing and reliving the show. And when Norm held out a $10 bill to me, I didn't understand what it was for.
"You're cut," he said. "We got 50 for the gig. 20 for me, because it's my bus and I play lead. 10 for each of you guys." I took it, still feeling like a boy in a dream, and slid open the side door with my aching left hand.
"Rehearsal this Thursday," Norm said. "Band room after school this time. I can't take you home, though. My dad needs me to help paint a house over in Castle Rock."
I said that was okay. If Con couldn't give me a ride home, I'd hitch. Most of the people who used Route 9 between Gates Falls and Harlow knew me and would pick me up.
"You need to work on Brown-Eyed Girl. You're way behind."
I said I would.
"And Jamie?"
I looked at him.
"Otherwise, you did okay."
"Better than Snuffy," Paul said.
"Way better than that hoser,"
Kenny added. That almost made up for Astrid's not being at the dance. Dad had gone to bed, but Mom was sitting at the kitchen table with a cup of tea. She had changed into a flannel nightgown, but she still had her makeup on, and I thought she looked very pretty. When she smiled, I saw her eyes were full of tears.
"Mom, are you okay?"
"Yes," she said. "I'm just happy for you, Jamie, and a little scared."
"Don't be,"
I said, and hugged her.
"You won't start smoking with those boys, will you? Promise me?"
"I already promised, Mom."
"Promise me again."
I did. Making promises when you're 14 is even easier than working up a sweat. Upstairs, Con was lying on his bed, reading a science book. It was hard for me to believe anyone would read such books for pleasure, especially a big-shot football player, but Connie did. He put it down and said,
"You were pretty good."
"How would you know?"
He smiled. "I peeked in, just for a minute. You were playing that asshole song."
"Wild Thing?"
I didn't even have to ask.
We played at the Amvets the following Friday night, and the high school dance on Saturday. At that one, Norm changed the words to, "I ain't gonna eat out my heart anymore," to, "I ain't gonna eat out my girl anymore." The chaperones didn't notice. They never noticed any of the lyrics, but the kids did and loved it. The Gates Gym was big enough to act as its own amplifier, and the sound we made, especially on really loud tunes like "Good Lovin'," was tremendous. If I may misquote Slade, "Us boys made big noise." During the break, Kenny went along with Norm and Paul to the smoking area, so I did too. There were several girls there, including Hattie Greer, the one who'd patted Norm's butt on the day I auditioned. She put her arms around his neck and pressed her body against his. He put his hands in her back pockets to pull her closer. I tried not to stare. A timid little voice came from behind me.
"Jamie?"
I turned. It was Astrid. She was wearing a straight white skirt and a blue sleeveless blouse. Her hair had been released from its prim school ponytail and framed her face.
"Hi," I said, and because that didn't seem like enough.
"Hi, Astrid. I didn't see you inside."
"I came late, because I had to ride with Bonnie and Bonnie's dad. You guys are really good."
"Thanks." Norm and Hattie were kissing strenuously. Norm was a noisy kisser, and the sound was a bit like my mom's Electrolux. There was other, quieter making out going on as well, but Astrid didn't seem to notice. Those luminous eyes never left my face. She was wearing frog earrings, blue frogs that matched her blouse. You notice everything at times like that. Meanwhile, she seemed to be waiting for me to say something else, so I amplified my previous remark.
"Thanks, a lot."
"Are you going to have a cigarette?"
"Me?"
It crossed my mind that she was spying for my mom.
"I don't smoke."
"Walk me back, then?"
I walked her back.
It was 400 yards between the smoking area and the back door of the gym. I wished it had been 4 miles. "Are you here with anybody?" I asked. "Just Bonnie and Carla," she said. "Not a guy or anything. Mom and Dad won't let me go out with guys until I'm 15. Then, as if to show me what she thought of such a silly idea, she took my hand. When we got to the back door, she looked up at me. I almost kissed her then, but lost my courage. Boys can be dopes. When we were loading Paul's drum kit into the back of the microbus after the dance, Norm spoke to me in a stern, almost paternal voice. "After the break, you were off on everything. What was that about?" "Don't know," I said. "Sorry. I'll do better next time."
"I hope so. If we're good, we get gigs. If we're not, we don't." He patted the rusty side of the microbus. "Betsy here don't run on air bubbles, and neither do I."
"It was that girl," Kenny said. "Pretty little blondie in a white skirt."
Norm looked enlightened. He put his hands on my shoulders and gave me a fatherly little shake to go with a fatherly voice.
"Get with her, little buddy, soon as you can. You'll play better."
Then he gave me $15. We played the Grange on New Year's Eve. It was snowing. Astrid was there. She was wearing a parka with a fur-lined hood. I led her under the fire escape and kissed her. She was wearing lipstick that tasted like strawberries. When I pulled back, she looked at me with those big eyes of hers.
"I thought you never would," she said, then giggled. "Was it all right?"
"Do it again, and I'll tell you."
We stood kissing under the fire escape until Norm tapped me on the shoulder.
"Break it up, kids. Time to play some music."
Astrid pecked me on the cheek.
"Do Wild Thing. I love that one," she said, and ran toward the back door, slipping around in her dancing shoes.
Norm and I followed.
"Blue balls much?" he asked.
"Huh?
Never mind. We're going to play her song first. You know how it works, right?"
I did, because the band played plenty of requests, and I was happy to do it, because now I felt more confident when I had the K in front of me, an electric shield plugged in and ready to drive.
We walked onto the stand. Paul hit the customary drum riff to signal that the band was back and ready to rock. Norm gave me a nod as he adjusted a guitar strap that didn't need adjusting. I stepped to the center mic and bellowed,
"This one is for Astrid, by request, and because, Wild Thing, I think I love you."
And although it was ordinarily Norm's job, his prerogative as leader of the band, I counted the song off.
1, 2, you know what to do.
On the floor, Astrid's friends were pummeling her and shrieking. Her cheeks were bright red. She blew me a kiss.
Astrid Soderbergh blew me a kiss.
So the boys in Chrome Roses had girlfriends. Or maybe they were groupies. Or maybe they were both. When you're in a band, it's not always easy to tell where the line is. Norm had Hattie. Paul had Suzanne Fournier. Kenny had Carol Plummer. And I had Astrid. Hattie, Suzanne, and Carol sometimes crammed into the microbus with us when we went to our gigs. Astrid wasn't allowed to do that. But when Suzanne was able to borrow her parents' car, Astrid was permitted to ride with the girls. Sometimes they got out on the floor and danced with each other. Mostly, they just stood in their own tight little clique and watched. Astrid and I spent most of the breaks kissing, and I began to taste cigarettes on her breath. I didn't mind. When she saw that, girls have ways of knowing, she started to smoke around me, and a couple of times she'd blow a little into my mouth while we were kissing. It gave me a hard-on I could have broken concrete with. A week after her 15th birthday, Astrid was allowed to go with us in the microbus to the Pal Hop in Lewiston. We kissed all the way home, and when I slipped my hand inside her coat to cup a breast that was now quite a bit more than a nubbin, she didn't push it away as she always had before.
"That feels good," she whispered in my ear. "I know it's wrong, but it feels good."
"Maybe that's why," I said. Sometimes boys aren't dopes. It was another month before she allowed my hand in her bra, and two before I was allowed to explore all the way up her skirt. But when I eventually got there, she admitted that also felt good. But beyond that, she would not go.
"I know I'd get pregnant the first time,"
she whispered in my ear, one night when we were parking and things had gotten especially hot. "I can get something at the drugstore. I could go to Lewiston, where they don't know me."
"Carol says sometimes those things break. That's what happened one time when she was with Kenny, and she was scared for a month. She said she thought her period would never come. But there are other things we can do," she told me. The other things were pretty good.
I got my license when I was 16, the only one of my siblings to succeed the first time I took the road test. I owed that partly to driver's ed and mostly to Cicero Irving. Norm lived with his mother, a good-hearted bottle blonde with a house in Gates Falls, but he spent most weekends with his dad, who lived in a scuzzy trailer park across the Harlow Line in Motton. If we had a gig on Saturday night, the band, along with our girlfriends, often got together at Cicero's trailer on Saturday afternoon for pizza. Joints were rolled and smoked, and after saying no for almost a year, I gave in and tried it. I found it hard to hold the smoke in at first, but, as many of my readers will know for themselves, it gets easier. I never smoked much dope in those days, just enough to get loose for the show. I played better when I had a little residual buzz on, and we always laughed a lot in that old trailer. When I told Cicero I was going for my license the following week, he asked me if my appointment was in Castle Rock or up the city, meaning Lewiston, Auburn. When I said it was L.A., he nodded sagely.
"That means you'll get Joe Cafferty. He's been doing that job for 20 years. I used to drink with him at the Mellow Tiger in Castle Rock when I was a constable there. This was before the Rock got big enough to have a regular PD, you know?"
It was hard to imagine Cicero Irving, grizzled, red-eyed, rail thin, rarely dressed in anything but old khakis and strappy T-shirts, being in the law enforcement biz. But people change. Sometimes they go up the ladder, and sometimes they go down. Those descending are frequently aided by various substances, such as the one he was so adept at rolling and sharing with his son's teenage compadres.
"Old Joey hardly ever gives anyone their license first crack out of the basket," Cicero said. "As a rule, he don't believe in it."
This I knew. Claire, Andy, and Con had all fallen afoul of Joe Cafferty. Terry drew someone else. Perhaps Officer Cafferty was sick that day. And although he was an excellent driver from the first time he got behind the wheel, Terry was a bundle of nerves that day and managed to back into a fire hydrant when he tried to parallel park.
"Three things if you want to pass," Cicero said, handing the joint he had just rolled to Paul Bouchard. "Number one, stay off this shit until after your road test."
"Okay." That was actually something of a relief. I enjoyed the bud. But with every toke, I remembered the promise I'd made to my mother and was now breaking. Although I consoled myself with the fact that I still wasn't smoking cigarettes or drinking, which meant I was batting .666.
"Second, call him sir. Thank you, sir, when you get in the car, and thank you, sir, when you get out. He likes that. Got it?"
"Got it."
"Third, and most important, cut your fucking hair. Joe Cafferty hates hippies."
I didn't like that idea one bit. I'd shot up 3 inches since joining the band, but when it came to hair, I was a slowpoke. It had taken me a year to get it almost down to my shoulders. There'd also been a lot of hair arguments with my parents, who told me I looked like a bum. Andy's verdict was even blunter. "If you want to look like a girl, Jamie, why don't you put on a dress?" "Gosh, there's nothing like reasoned Christian discourse, is there?" "Oh, man, if I cut my hair, I'll look like a nerd." "You look like a nerd already," Kenny said, and everyone laughed. Even Astrid laughed, then put a hand on my thigh to take the sting out of it.
"Yeah," Sister Irving said. "You look like a nerd with a driver's license. Paulie, are you going to fire up that joint or just sit there and admire it?"
I laid off the bud. I called Officer Cafferty, sir. I got a Mr. Businessman haircut, which broke my heart and lifted my mother's. When I parallel parked, I tapped the bumper of the car behind me, but Officer Cafferty gave me my license anyway. "I'm trusting you, son," he said.
"Thank you, sir," they said. "I won't let you down."
When I turned 17, there was a birthday party for me at our house, which now stood on a paved road, the March of Progress. Astrid was invited, of course, and she gave me a sweater she had knitted herself. I pulled it on at once, although it was August and the day was hot. Mom gave me a hardbound set of Kenneth Roberts' historical novels, which I actually read. Andy gave me a leather-bound Bible, which I also read, mostly to spite him, with my name stamped in gold on the front. The inscription on the flyleaf was from Revelation 3. "Behold, I stand at the door and knock. If any man hear my voice and open the door, I will come in to him." The implication that I had fallen away was not exactly unwarranted. From Claire, now 25 and teaching school in New Hampshire, I got a spiffy sport coat. Con, always something of a cheapie, gave me 6 sets of guitar strings. Oh well, at least they were dollar slicks. Mom brought in the birthday cake, and everyone sang the traditional song. If Norm had been there, he probably would have blown the candles out with his rock and roll voice, but he wasn't, so I blew them out myself. As Mom was passing the plates around, I realized I hadn't gotten anything from Dad or Terry, not so much as a flower power tie. After the cake and ice cream, Van Chalk Straw, of course, I saw Terry flash Dad a glance. Dad looked at Mom, and she gave him a nervous little smile. It is only in retrospect that I realized how often I saw that nervous smile on my mother's face as her children grew up and went into the world. "Come on out to the barn, Jamie," my dad said, standing up. "Terrence and I have got a little something for you." The little something turned out to be a 1966 Ford Galaxy. It was washed, waxed, and as white as moonlight on snow. "Oh, my God," I said in a faint voice, and everyone laughed. "The body was good, but the engine needed some work," Terry said. "Me and Dad reground the valves, replaced the plugs, and stuck in a new battery, the works." "New tires," Dad said, pointing to them. "Just black walls, but those are not recaps. Do you like it, son?" I hugged him. I hugged them both. "Just promise me and your mother that you'll never get behind the wheel if you've taken a drink. Don't make us have to look at each other someday and say we gave you something you used to hurt yourself or someone else." "I promise," I said. Astrid, with whom I would share the last inch or so of a joint when I took her home in my new car, squeezed my arm. "And I'll make him keep it." After driving down to Harry's Pond twice, I had to make 2 trips so I could give everyone a ride, history repeated itself. I felt a tug on my hand. It was Claire. She led me into the mudroom, just as she had on the day Reverend Jacobs used his electrical nerve stimulator to give Connie back his voice. "Mom wants another promise from you," she said. But she was too embarrassed to ask. So I said I'd do it for her. I waited. Astrid is a nice girl, Claire said. She smokes. I can smell it on her breath. But that doesn't make her bad. And she's a girl with good taste. Going with you for 3 years proves that. I waited. She's a smart girl, too. She's got college ahead of her. So here's the promise, Jamie. Don't you get her pregnant in the back seat of that car. Can you promise that? I almost smiled. If I had, it would have been 50% amused and 50% pained. For the last 2 years, Astrid and I had had a code word, recess. It meant mutual masturbation. I had mentioned condoms to her on several occasions after the first time, had even gone so far as to purchase a 3-pack of Trojans, one kept in my wallet, the other two secreted behind the baseboard in my bedroom. But she was positive that the first one we tried would either break or leak. So, recess. You're mad at me, aren't you? Claire asked. No, I said. Never mad at you, Claire Bear. And I never was. That anger was waiting for the monster she married, and it never abated. I hugged her and promised I would not get Astrid pregnant. It was a promise I kept. Although we got close before that day in the cabin near Skytop. In those years, I sometimes dreamed of Charles Jacobs. I'd see him poking his fingers into my pretend mountain to make caves, or preaching the terrible sermon with blue fire circling his head like an electric diadem. But he pretty much slipped from my conscious mind until one day in June of 1974. I was 18. So was Astrid. School was out. Chrome Roses had gigs lined up all summer, including a couple in bars where my parents had given me reluctant written permission to perform. And during the days I'd be working at the Marsteller's farm stand, as I had the year before. Morton Fuel Oil was doing well, and my parents could afford tuition at the University of Maine, but I was expected to do my share. I had a week before reporting for farm stand duty, though. So Astrid and I had a lot of time together. Sometimes we went to my house, sometimes we were at hers. On a lot of afternoons, we cruised the back roads in my galaxy. We'd find a place to park, and then recess. That afternoon, we were in a disused gravel pit on Route 9, swapping a joint of not very good local grass back and forth. It was sultry, and storm clouds were forming in the west. Thunder rumbled, and there must have been lightning. I didn't see it, but static crackled from the dashboard radio speaker, momentarily blotting out Smokin' in the Boys' Room, a song the Roses played at every show that year. That was when Reverend Jacobs returned to my mind like a long absent guest, and I started the car. "Snuff that, Jay," I said. "Let's go for a ride." "Where?" "A place someone told me about a long time ago, if it's still there." Astrid put the remains of the joint in a Sucrets box and tucked it under the seat. I drove a mile or two down Route 9, then turned west on Goat Mountain Road. Here the trees bulked close on either side, and the last of that day's hazy sunshine disappeared as the storm clouds rolled in. "If you're thinking about the resort, they won't let us in," Astrid said. "My folks gave up their membership. They said they had to economize if I'm going to college in Boston." She wrinkled her nose. "Not the resort," I said. We passed Longmeadow, where the MYF used to have its annual weenie roast. People were throwing nervous glances at the sky as they gathered up their blankets and coolers and hurried to their cars. The thunder was louder now, loaded wagons rolling across the sky. And I saw a bolt of lightning hit somewhere on the other side of Skytop. I started to feel excited. "Beautiful," Charles Jacobs had said that day. "Beautiful and terrifying." We passed a sign reading, "Goat Mountain Gatehouse, 1 mile. Please show membership card." "Jamie, there's supposed to be a spur that goes to Skytop," I said. "Maybe it's gone, but..." It wasn't gone, and it was still gravel. I turned into it a little too fast
and the galaxy's rear end wagged first one way, then the other.
"I hope you know what you're doing," Astrid said.
She didn't sound frightened to be driving straight toward a summer thunderstorm. She sounded interested and a little excited.
"I hope so, too."
The grade steepened. The galaxy's rear end flirted on the loose gravel from time to time, but mostly it held steady. 2.5 miles beyond the turnoff, the trees pulled back, and there was Skytop. Astrid gasped and sat up straight in her seat. I hit the brake and brought my car to a crunching stop. On our right was an old cabin with a mossy, sagging roof and crashed-out windows. Graffiti, most of it too faded to be legible, danced in tangles across the gray, paintless sides. Ahead and above us was a great, bulging forehead of granite. At the summit, just as Jacobs had told me half my life ago, was an iron pole jutting toward the clouds, which were now black and seemingly low enough to touch. To our left, where Astrid was looking, hills and fields and gray-green miles of woods stretched toward the ocean. In that direction, the sun was still shining, making the world glow.
"Oh, my God. Was this here all the time? And you never took me?"
"I never took myself," I said. "My old minister told me." That was as far as I got. A brilliant bolt of lightning came down from the sky. Astrid screamed and put her hands over her head. For a moment, strange, terrible, wonderful, it seemed to me that the air had been replaced by electric oil. I felt the hair all over my body, even the fine ones in my nose and ears, go stiff. Then came the click, as if an invisible giant had snapped his fingers. A second bolt flashed down and hit the iron rod, turning it the same bright blue I'd seen dancing around Charles Jacobs' head in my dreams. I had to shut my eyes to keep from going blind. When I opened them again, the pole was glowing, cherry red. "Like a horseshoe in a forge," he'd said. And that was just what it was like. Follow Thunder bellowed. "Do you want to get out of here?" I was shouting. I had to, in order to hear myself over the ringing in my ears.
"No," she shouted back. "In there,"
and pointed at the slumping remains of the cabin. I thought of telling her we'd be safer in the car. Some vaguely remembered adage about how rubber tires could ground you and protect you from lightning. But there had been thousands of storms on Skytop, and the old cabin was still standing. As we ran toward it, hand in hand, I realized there was a good reason for that. The iron rod drew the lightning. At least it had so far. It began to hail as we reached the open door, pebble-sized chunks of ice that struck the granite with a rattling sound.
"Ouch, ouch, ouch!"
Astrid yelled, but she was laughing at the same time. She darted in. I followed just as the lightning flashed again, artillery on some apocalyptic battlefield. This time it was preceded by a snap instead of a click. Astrid seized my shoulder.
"Look!"
I'd missed the storm's second swipe at the iron rod, but I clearly saw what followed. Balls of St. Elmo's fire bounced and rolled down the scree-littered slope. There were half a dozen. One by one, they popped out of existence. Astrid hugged me, but that wasn't enough. She locked her hands around my neck and climbed me, her thighs locked around my hips.
"This is fantastic," she screamed.
The hail turned to rain, and it came in a deluge. Skytop was blotted out, but we never lost sight of the iron rod, because it was struck repeatedly. It would glow blue or purple, then red, then fade, only to be struck again. Rain like that rarely lasts long. As it lessened, we saw that the granite slope below the iron rod had turned into a river. The thunder continued to rumble, but it was losing its fury and subsiding into sulks. We heard running water everywhere, as if the earth were whispering. The sun was still shining to the east over Brunswick and Freeport and Jerusalem's Lot, where we saw not one or two rainbows, but half a dozen, interlocking like Olympic rings. Astrid turned me toward her.
"I have to tell you something," she said. Her voice was low.
"What?"
I was suddenly sure that she would destroy this transcendent moment by telling me we had to break up. Last month, my mother took me to the doctor. She said she didn't want to know how serious we were about each other, that it wasn't her business, but she needed to know I was taking care of myself. That's how she put it. All you have to say is that you want it because your periods are painful and irregular, she said. When he sees that I brought you myself, that will do. I was a little slow, I guess, so she punched me in the chest. Birth control pills, dummy. Overall, it's safe now, because I had a period since I started taking them. I've been waiting for the right time, and if this isn't it, there won't ever be one. Those luminous eyes on mine. Then she dropped them and began biting her lip. Just don't get carried away, all right? Think of me and be gentle, because I'm scared. Carol said her first time hurt like hell. We undressed each other, all the way, at last, while the clouds unraveled overhead and the sun shone through and the whisper of running water began to die away. Her arms and legs were already tanned. The rest of her was as white as snow. Her pubic hair was fine gold, accentuating her sex rather than obscuring it. There was an old mattress in the corner where the roof was still whole. We weren't the first to use that cabin for what it was used for that day. She guided me in, then made me stop. I asked her if it was all right. She said it was, but that she wanted to do it herself. Hold still, honey. Just hold still. I held still. It was agony to hold still, but it was also wonderful to hold still. She raised her hips. I slid in a little deeper. She did it again, and I slipped in a little more. I remember looking at the mattress and seeing its old, faded pattern and smudges of dirt and a single trundling ant. That she raised her hips again. I slid in all the way, and she gasped. Oh, my God. Does it hurt? Astrid, does it? No. It's wonderful. I think you can do it now. I did. We did. That was our summer of love. We made it in several places. Once in Norm's bedroom in Cicero Irving's trailer, where we broke his bed and had to put it back together. But mostly we used the cabin at Skytop. It was our place, and we wrote our names on one of the walls, among 50 others. There was never another storm, though. Not that summer. In the fall, I went to the University of Maine, and Astrid went to Suffolk University in Boston. I assumed this would be a temporary separation. We'd see each other on vacations, and at some hazy point in the future, when we both had our degrees, we'd marry. One of the few things I've learned since then about the fundamental differences between the sexes is this. Men make assumptions, but women rarely do. On the day of the thunderstorm, as we were driving home, Astrid said, "I'm glad you were my first." I told her I was glad, too, not even thinking about what that implied. There was no big breakup scene. We just drifted apart. And if there was an architect for that gradual withering, it was Delia Soderbergh, Astrid's pretty, quiet mother, who was unfailingly pleasant but always looked at me the way a storekeeper studies a suspicious $20 bill. "Maybe it's all right," the storekeeper thinks, "but there's just a little something off about it." If Astrid had gotten pregnant, my assumptions about our future might have proved correct. And hey, we might have been very happy. 3 kids, 2-car garage, backyard swimming pool, all the rest. But I don't think so. I think the constant gigging and the girls who always hang around rock bands would have broken us up. Looking back, I have to think that Delia Soderbergh's suspicions were justified. I was a counterfeit 20. good enough to pass in most places, maybe, but not in her store. There was no big breakup scene with Chrome Roses, either. On my first weekend home from school in Orono, I played with the band at the Amvets on Friday night and at Scooter's Pub in North Conway on Saturday. We sounded as good as ever, and we were now hauling down 150 a gig. I remember I sang lead on Shake Your Moneymaker and played a pretty good harp solo. But when I came home for Thanksgiving, I discovered that Norm had hired a new rhythm guitarist and changed the name of the band to Norman's Knights.
"Sorry, man," he said, shrugging. "The offers were piling up, and I can't work in a trio. Drums, bass, two guitars, that's rock and roll."
"That's okay," I said. "I get it." And I did, because he was right. Or almost. Drums, bass, two guitars, and everything starts in the key of E.
"We're playing the Ragged Pony in Winthrop tomorrow night, if you want to sit in. Guest artist kind of thing."
"I'll pass," I said. I'd heard the new rhythm guitarist. He was a year younger than me and already better. He could chicken scratch like a mad bastard. Besides, that meant I could spend Saturday night with Astrid, which I did. I suspect she was already dating other guys by then. She was too pretty to stay home. But she was discreet and loving. It was a good Thanksgiving. I didn't miss Chrome Roses or Norman's Knights, a name I would never have to get used to, which suited me fine, at all. Well, you know, hardly at all. One day not long before Christmas break, I dropped by the Bear's Den in the University of Maine Memorial Union for a burger and a Coke. On the way out, I stopped to look at the bulletin board. Among the litter of file cards advertising textbooks for sale, cars for sale, and rides wanted to various destinations, I found this. "Good news. The Cumberlands are reuniting. Bad news. We're short a rhythm guitarist. We are a loud and proud cover band. If you can play Beatles, Stones, Badfinger, McCoys, Barbarians, Standells, Birds, etc., come to room 421, Cumberland Hall, and bring your axe. If you like Emerson, Lake and Palmer, or Blood, Sweat and Tears, stay the fuck away." By then I had a bright red Gibson SG. And that afternoon after class, I toted it over to Cumberland Hall, where I met Jay Pedersen. Because of noise restrictions during study hours, we played tennis racket style in his room. Later that night, we plugged in down in the dorm's rec area. We rocked the place for half an hour, and I got the gig. He was a lot better than me, but I was used to that. I had, after all, started my rock and roll career with Norm Irving. "I'm thinking of changing the name of the band to the Heaters," Jay said. "What do you think?" "As long as I get time to study during the week and you split fare, I don't care if you call it Assholes from Hell." "Good name. Right up there with Doug and the Hot Nuts. But I don't think we get many high school dances." He offered me his hand. I clasped it. We gave each other that dead fish shake. "Welcome aboard, Jamie. Rehearsal Wednesday night. Be there or be square." I was many things, but square wasn't one of them. I was there for almost two decades, and a dozen bands in 100 cities, I was there. A rhythm guitarist can always find work, even if he's so stoned he can barely stand. Basically, it all comes down to two things. You have to show up, and you have to be able to play a bar E. My problem started when I stopped showing up. Chapter 5. The Fluid Passage of Time, Portraits and Lightning, My Drug Problem. When I graduated from the University of Maine, 2.9 cum, missed the dean's list by a coat of paint, I was 22. When I met Charles Jacobs for the second time, I was 36. He looked younger than his age. Perhaps because when I saw him last, he had been thinned and made haggard by grief. By 1992, I looked much older than mine. I've always been a movie fan. During the 1980s, I saw a lot of them, mostly on my own. I dozed off on occasion, Heathers, for instance,
That one was a nodder for sure. But mostly I'd make it through no matter how stoned I was, surfing on noise and color, and impossibly beautiful women in scanty clothing. Books are good, and I read my share, and TV's okay if you're stuck in a motel room during a rainstorm. But for Jamie Morton, there was nothing like a movie up there on the big screen. Just me, my popcorn, and my supersized Coke, plus my heroin, of course. I'd take an extra straw from the concession stand, bite it in half, and use it to snort the powder off the back of my hand. I didn't get to the needle until 1990 or 91, but I got there eventually. Most of us do. Trust me on this. The first thing I find most charming about the movies is this fluid way time passes. You might start off with this nerdy teenager, no friends, no money, lousy parents, and all at once he turns into Brad Pitt in his prime. The only thing separating the nerd from the god is a title card that says 14 years later. It's wicked to wish time away, my mother used to lecture us kids. Usually when we were pining for summer vacation in the depths of February, or waiting for Halloween to hurry up and come. And probably she was right, but I can't help thinking that such temporal jumps might be a good thing for people living bad lives, and between the advent of the Reagan administration in 1980 and the Tulsa State Fair in 1992, I was living a very bad life. There were blackouts, but no title cards. I had to live every day of those years, and when I couldn't get high, some of the days were 100 hours long. The fade-in goes like this. The Cumberlands became the Heaters, and the Heaters became the J-Tones. Our last gig as a college band was the huge and hilarious graduation dance, 78 and Memorial Gym. We played from 8 until 2 in the morning. Shortly thereafter, Jay Pedersen hired a locally popular chick vocalist who could also play tenor and alto sax like nobody's business. Her name was Robin Storrs. She turned out to be a perfect fit for us. And by August, the J-Tones had become Robin and the Jays. We turned it into one of Maine's premier party bands. We had all the gigs we could play, and life was good. Now here comes the dissolve. 14 years later, Jamie Morton woke up in Tulsa. Not in a very good hotel. Not even in a so-so chain motel. This was a roach pit called the Fairgrounds Inn. Such places were Kelly Van Dorn's idea of economy. It was 11 in the morning, and the bed was wet. I wasn't surprised. When you crash for 19 hours, assisted by Madam H., wetting your bed is almost inevitable. I suppose you'd even do it if you died in that drug-assisted slumber, although look at the bright side. In that case, you'd never wake up in pee-soaked jockeys again. I did the zombie walk to the bathroom, sniffling and watering at the eyes, shucking my skivvies on the way. I made my shaving kit the first stop, but not to clear the stubble. My works were still there, along with a taped-down sandwich bag containing a couple of grams. No reason to think anyone would break in to steal such a paltry stash, but checking is second nature to a junkie. With that taken care of, I addressed the bowl and rid myself of the urine that had accumulated since my nighttime accident. As I was standing there, I realized that something of importance had slipped my mind. I was currently playing with a country crossover band, and we had been scheduled to open for Sawyer Brown the night before, on the big Oklahoma stage at the Tulsa State Fair, a primo gig, especially for a not-ready-for-Nashville band like White Lightning. "Sound check at 5 o'clock," Kelly Van Dorn had told me. "You'll be there, right?" "Sure," I'd said. "Don't worry about me." Oops. Coming out of the bathroom, I saw a folded note poking under the door. I had a pretty good idea what it said, but I picked it up and read it, just to be sure. It was short and not so sweet. "I called the Union High Music Department and lucked into a kid who could play just enough rhythm and slide guitar to get us through.
He was happy to pocket your $600. By the time you get this, we'll be on the way to Wildwood Green. Don't even think about following us. You're fired. Sorry as hell to do it, but enough is enough. Kelly. P.S. I guess you probably won't pay attention to this, Jamie. But if you don't clean up your act, you'll be in prison a year from now. That's if you're lucky. Dead if you're not.
I tried to stick the note in my back pocket, and it fell on the balding green carpet instead. I'd forgotten that I wasn't wearing anything. I picked it up, tossed it in the wastebasket, and peeked out the window. The courtyard parking lot was totally empty except for an old Ford and some farmer's broke-ass pickup. Both the Explorer the band rode in and the equipment van that our sound guy drove were gone. Kelly hadn't been kidding. The out-of-tune nutbags had left me, which was probably all for the best. I sometimes thought if I had to play one more drinking and cheating song, I'd lose what little mind I had left. I decided to make re-upping the room my first priority. I had no desire to spend another night in Tulsa, especially with the state fair going full blast down the street. But I need some time to think about my next career move. I needed to score, too. And if you can't find someone to sell you dope at a state fair, you're not trying. I kicked the damp skivvies into the corner. A tip for the chambermaid, I thought snidely, and unzipped my duffel. Nothing in there but dirty clothes. I'd meant to find a laundromat yesterday, another thing that had slipped my mind. But at least they were dry, dirty clothes. I dressed and trekked across the cracked asphalt of the courtyard to the motel office. My zombie walk slowly perking up to the zombie shuffle. My throat hurt every time I swallowed. Just a little extra something to add to the fun. The lady on the desk was a hard-faced country girl of about 50, currently living her life under a volcano of teased red hair. A talk show host was on her little television, chatting up a storm with Nicole Kidman. Above the TV was a framed picture of Jesus, bringing a boy and a girl, a puppy. I was in no way surprised. In flyover country, they have a way of getting Christ and Santa all mixed up.
"Your group is already checked out,"
she said after finding my name in a registered book. She had a local accent, which sounded like a badly tuned banjo.
"Left a couple of hours ago. Said they were driving all the way to North Carolina."
"I'm aware," I said. "I'm no longer with the band." She raised an eyebrow. "Creative differences," I said. The eyebrow climbed higher. "I'll be staying another night."
"Uh-huh. Okay. Cash or credit card?"
I had 200 or so in cash, but most of that liquidity was earmarked for the dope purchase I hoped to make at the fair, so I gave her my Bank America card. She called it in and waited, phone cocked between her ear and one meaty shoulder, now watching an ad for paper towels that could apparently drink up spills the size of Lake Michigan. I watched with her. When the talk show returned, Nicole Kidman was joined by Tom Selleck, and the country girl was still on hold. She didn't seem to mind, but I did. The itches had started, and my bad leg was starting to throb. Just as another ad came on, the country girl perked up. She swiveled around in her chair, looked out her window at a blazing blue Oklahoma sky, and chatted briefly. Then she hung up and handed back my credit card.
"Declined. Which makes me dubious about taking cash, supposing you have it."
That was mean, but I gave her my best smile just the same. "The card's good. They made a mistake. It happens all the time."
"Then you'll be able to rectify it at some other motel," she said.
Rectify? Such a big word for a country girl.
"There's four more down the block, but they ain't much."
Unlike this roadside Ritz-Carlton, I thought, but what I said was, "Try the card again."
"Honey," she said, "I look at you, and I don't have to."
I sneezed, turning my head to catch it on the short sleeve of my Charlie Daniels band tee, which was okay since it hadn't been washed lately, or even not so lately. "What's that supposed to mean?"
"It means I left my first husband when him and both his brothers took to smoking the rock. No offense, but I know what I'm looking at. Last night's paid for on the band's credit card, but now that you're what they call a solo artist, checkout time's 1 o'clock.
On the door, it says 3. She leveled a chip nail at a sign to the left of the calendar featuring puppy-giving Jesus. During State Fair, September 25th to October 4th, checkout time will be 1 p.m. Checkout is spelled wrong, I said. You should rectify that. She glanced at the sign and then turned back to me.
So 'tis. But the 1 p.m. part needs no rectifying, she glanced at her watch. That gives you an hour and a half. Don't make me call the police, hon. At State Fair time, they're thickened flies and a fresh dog turd, and they be here in a jiff.
This is such bullshit, I said. That was a blurry time for me, but I remember her reply as clearly as if she had spoken it in my ear 2 minutes ago.
Uh-uh, honey. This is reality.
Then she turned back to the television, where some fool was tap dancing. I wasn't going to try scoring dope in the daytime, not even at the state fair, so I stayed at the fairgrounds inn until 1:30, just to spite the country girl. Then I grabbed my duffel in one hand, my guitar case in the other, and set out walking. I made a stop at a Texaco station around where North Detroit Avenue becomes South Detroit. By then, my walk had become a port side limp, and my hip was throbbing with my heartbeat. In the men's room, I cooked up and delivered half my goods into the hollow of my left shoulder. Mellowness ensued. Both my sore throat and the ache in my leg began to recede. My good left leg became my bad left leg on a sunny summer day in 1980.